Hello, and welcome to my podcast. This is an audio version of my videos, available to make listening to my stuff in the background easier than YouTube makes it. But since my videos are primarily made for YouTube, there may be occasional references to visual materials. If you'd like this podcast ad-free, you can join us on Patreon at patreon.com/vicerhino. Please enjoy. Hello, and welcome to my channel. Vice Rhino here. Today, I'm switching things up a bit. I recently noticed that a channel that has made a 10 Questions for Atheists video, which I responded to in the past, just made another 10 Questions for Atheists video. And just going by how he phrased things in his video, I got the feeling that he considers this kind of video to be a good method of generating attention, which he can then use as content fodder for the next several months. So I figured, what the hell? I'll jump on the bandwagon and make some bait of my own. And, well, this whole thing is at least a little bit tongue-in-cheek. Generally, I actually kind of hate these 10 questions type of videos. These are all genuine questions that I have about Christianity, things that I have never seen adequate answers to. So let's go! So, question number one. Why is God obsessed with blood? In the Old Testament, he's very particular about what you do with the blood of your sacrifices, sprinkling it in just the right way, in just the right places, painting it over your doorposts, etc. In the New Testament, this carries forward, with Jesus being the ultimate sacrifice, and songs being sung about how we are washed clean in his blood, and the ritual drinking of his blood, which, depending on your denomination, you believe actually turns into real blood at some point during the communion process.
Yes, sir. Now his blood is in my body.
Yes, sir.
It's in there. His blood is mixed with my blood. Can you see it?
The explanation, as I understand it, is that God needs something to pay the price for sin. In the Old Testament, that was the sacrificial animals. This doesn't quite explain why there are different types of sacrifices that have different procedures for blood sprinkling, but okay, something needs to pay for sin. But did God not make the rules? Could he not have chosen something less barbaric? And why does the emphasis have to stay on blood after Jesus? I've heard it said that there's special power in Jesus' blood because he is God, and that's literally God's blood. So there's special power in God's blood. But did God not choose which substance to imbue with his power? Could he not have chosen something a bit more sanitary? And was the human sacrifice part really necessary? After all, he is God. Can he not choose to just forgive anyone who sincerely seeks forgiveness without there being a death first? Now, yeah, blah, 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 perfect justice demands a penalty be paid. But who's in charge here, God or justice? Is God not also perfectly merciful? And what is mercy but the suspension of justice? And let's just hypothetically grant that hell is actually a just punishment for not believing in Jesus. Is sending Jesus to hell for a couple days really a just substitution for sending billions of people to hell for eternity? I mean, I know he's God, so the punishment is supposed to be extra harsh or something, but really, he's God, so he's obviously perfectly capable of enduring whatever tortures he wants to endure without it actually causing him any harm. So he was mildly inconvenienced for part of a weekend for your sins. Question 2. Why did God create Satan? Usually the response that I've gotten to this one is that God didn't create Satan. God created Lucifer, and Lucifer used his free will to become Satan. But there's a few problems here. First, the passage where we get the name Lucifer from is Isaiah 14:12. How you are fallen from heaven, O day star, son of dawn. How you are cut down to the ground, you who laid the nations low. The Hebrew word for the day star or morning star was translated into the Latin Vulgate as Lucifer, which is where the name comes from. But importantly, if we read this verse in context, it isn't talking about Satan, it's talking about the king of Babylon. It really is quite explicit about this fact. It literally says, "When the Lord has given you rest from your pain and turmoil and the hard service with which you were made to serve, you will take up this taunt against the King of Babylon." Not against the Prince of Darkness, not against Satan, against the King of Babylon. And then it goes on into the poem, which includes this verse about Lucifer. This passage was not interpreted to be about Satan until Origen of Alexandria argued in the 3rd century that it couldn't be about a human because it talks about falling from heaven, and no human can do that. Never mind the fact that the Bible, especially the Old Testament, often uses heaven as a synonym for sky. After all, the same word that is translated as heaven here in this passage is used to describe where birds fly in Genesis 1:20. And given the fact that kings and rulers were often spoken about as ruling from on high or being higher than their subjects, using a word that pretty obviously implies a significant height in a metaphor about a king falling from his high ruling place and being brought low makes perfect sense. Now, when Job talks about Satan, there is no indication that Satan is supposed to be a proper noun here, but even if we assume that it is, in Job, Satan is pretty clearly working for God. He's a member of God's court, and it is his job, as appointed by God, to find and root out the evil that might be hidden, hence the trials of Job. He's trying to find out whether or not Job has any evil hidden in him. In Job, Satan's character is the bad guy, in the same sense that Inspector Javert is the bad guy in Les Miserables. He is simply overzealous in his work in finding and exposing evil. But all of this is kind of tangential to the point. Let's, for argument's sake, agree that the interpretation of Satan that didn't show up until centuries after Jesus' death is the accurate interpretation, somehow. So, Satan was formerly the angel Lucifer, and his rebellion against God caused him to be cast out of heaven. God didn't create Satan, he created Lucifer. Well, this is kind of a meaningless distinction. He created a being that he knew would become Satan. Was God incapable of not creating him? Like, even if I grant that God gave Lucifer free will, even though there's nothing in the Bible that even hints at that, and the Bible does explicitly say that God created evil in Isaiah 45:7, but just forget about that. Let's just grant the whole God gave Lucifer free will thing. Was God unaware of what Lucifer would do with his free will? Now, let's also ignore the paradox that's brought about by knowing the future and free will. Somehow, free will exists, even though God knows all of his creation's future actions before he creates them. Does that not mean that he could choose not to make the beings who will freely choose to cause trouble, especially the ones like Satan, who will literally be responsible for all of the evil that ever happens in all of creation? At least, according to the modern Christian interpretation of who Satan is. And this actually leads nicely into my next question, number 3. Why does God create people that he knows will end up in hell? I mean, I get the whole free will thing. God doesn't just want robots who will worship him, he wants people who will freely choose to worship him. But this brings us back to the problem of knowing the future not mixing well with free will. I mean, I guess you could wiggle out of that paradox as long as the being who knows the future is not also the being responsible for creating literally everything, but as long as the being who knows the future is the one who set everything in motion in the first place, that means that free will isn't really possible. He knew all of the downstream consequences of every single one of his creative actions. Again, according to the modern Christian interpretation. If you actually read the books without presupposing that modern Christianity is correct in its interpretation, you actually come away from them with a much more limited picture of who God is. And so even though God steps in occasionally to mess with free will, you could claim that humanity in general has free will on account of God's ignorance of the future consequences of present actions. But modern Christianity just won't have that. God knows everything, past, present, and future. And on top of all of this, the Bible is rather explicit about the fact that God decides who has children when. Being unable to conceive children is often a punishment, and a reward for being extra holy is often to be gifted with children. In fact, as my daughter and I read through Genesis, after the initial creation story, basically the only thing God has done so far is to show up and promise lots of offspring to his favorite people. My daughter gets annoyed now whenever God shows up to say something, because she knows what he's gonna say is going to be all about a covenant to have lots of offspring.
No, what does God usually say when he shows up?
Offspring, offspring, covenant, bye.
And of course, this is all in addition to the passage about him knitting you together in your mother's womb, which, in context, is actually about one specific person, but again, in modern Christian interpretation, that seems to be extrapolated out to everybody. So the Bible is quite clear that God decided who to create, and since he knows the future, he also knows every time he creates someone whether they will end up in heaven or hell. And he still creates people that he knows will go to hell, even though the Christians will tell you that he doesn't want a single person to end up there. But we rebel and go there of our own volition anyway. Usually, the responses I've heard to this one just go right back to God not wanting worship robots, but that kind of misses the point. If God knows the future, and God creates all the babies, then the people who choose to worship God are still worship robots. They're just also exist rebel robots. The presence of robots that God will send to hell doesn't make the worship robots any less robotic. And if free will can somehow be salvaged here, it doesn't change the fact that God still knows the future destination of all the babies that he makes. So if not making the people who will go to hell would then somehow cause the people who go to heaven to not have free will, then that just means there is no free will in the first place. The presence or absence of hellbound individuals does not change that fact. And that leads us into my next question. Convenient that these questions are ordered in a way where they lead into each other, isn't it? Almost like the person who is in control of creating them was also in control of their outcome or something. Anyway, the next question is essentially the problem of evil. How can God be good when he allows evil? Not only does he allow evil, he is present for it. All of it. When someone is murdered, he is there. When a car smashes into a pedestrian, that car literally has to go through God in order to get to that pedestrian, because God is omnipresent. You know those scenes that are always played as heroic in movies where people say, to get to them, you have to go through me first?
You have to get through me first.
Okay, nighty-night!
Yeah, God is literally the exact opposite of that. Oh, you want to murder this child here? Let me get out of your way so I don't even provide the most minor of barriers to you. I mean, occasionally things happen that end up foiling a potential criminal plan, and sometimes such occurrences are attributed to God, but if I grant that, then that means that God does intervene. Sometimes. So, God intervened to stop person A from being raped and murdered. Praise Jesus! Okay. What sort of message does that send to the family of person B, who actually was raped and murdered? And usually this is where mysterious ways come in. Some good will be brought about by the evil that God allowed, which will be greater than the evil that God allowed. Which is actually a really weird position to hold, considering that Christians can often be found complaining about how bad the times are, and they're only getting worse. If every bad thing that happens is a part of God's plan to bring about a greater good, then shouldn't the world be getting consistently better year after year? To which the more sophisticated apologist might be inclined to point out that the world is, in fact, consistently getting better. Which is true, it is. But most Christians interpret Matthew 24:37 as predicting that the world will continue in a moral decline until the second coming. I mean, that's not what it's actually saying if you read it in context, which they seem to be bad at reading their own book in context. Funny that. Anywho, if you read it in context, it's really just talking about how nobody knew that the flood was coming in Noah's day. They just continued living normally, and it'll be the same for Jesus. Nobody, not even Jesus himself, knows when he will return. Which seems odd if Jesus is God and God is omniscient. My point is, an acknowledgement that things are, on the whole, getting better as time goes on, morally speaking at least, goes against the modern mainstream Christian views. And really, even for those who agree that things are getting better, would it not be better still if God just intervened and stopped bad things from happening in the first place? Would that not actually be the best? He doesn't even have to mess with free will to do it. He just has to intervene in whatever way it is that he does to help someone find their car keys, but instead of being helpful, be a hindrance to those that would do bad things. Is this guy that's about to get into his vehicle on his way to kidnap someone? Okay, he loses his car keys. Should he find them, his car won't start. Should he fix it, he has a single vehicle collision on his way to the kidnapping, which doesn't actually hurt anyone, it just stops him from being able to get there. He still has free will. He has the will to do the bad things, but he can never quite accomplish the bad thing, because God is always there, getting in the way. Speaking of morality, question 5. Why do you borrow secular morality if God really is the source of morality? Let me explain. The moral argument for God claims that objective morals cannot exist without God, and objective morals do exist, therefore God exists. There are a lot of problems with this argument, not the least of which is that objective morals do not actually appear to exist, but really, we're supposed to be getting our morals from God. That's the core of the argument. And the Bible is supposed to be God's word. And the Bible endorses slavery. It treats women as property. It has barbaric punishments for non-crimes, like being disrespectful to your parents, carrying the death penalty. It's against equal rights, also having the death penalty for the non-crime of being gay. And I could go on. Clearly, modern humans do not get their morality from the Bible. But of course, the Bible is telling the history of people that often behaved immorally. Really, morality is written on our hearts. The fact that everyone agrees that torturing babies for fun is wrong is proof of this.
Every one of us knows that torturing an innocent baby for fun is wrong.
That we know that it's objectively wrong to torture infants for fun.
Do we understand that torturing babies for fun is really wrong?
Okay, well, let me ask you this, apologist who always seems to need to add the for fun modifier onto this statement. Why does the motivation of the person doing the torturing matter? If it's objectively wrong, the reason the person is doing the objectively wrong thing should be irrelevant. When you add for fun onto the end of this statement, that is an implicit admission that you think there are scenarios in which torturing babies is not wrong. But as common as that example is, that's not really my point here. If you believe that the Bible is true, then one thing that goes along with that is that God has, on occasion, commanded his people to commit genocide, wiped out entire races of people. Even if we grant the fact that the ancient authors often used hyperbolic language, which would allow for these genocides to not actually be genocides, there are definitely a few places where genocide is inescapably the end goal, like 1 Samuel 15. Not only does God demand that Israel kill all of the Amalekites, including all their babies, infants, children, and animals, but because this command was not fully carried out to the letter, God rejected Saul as king. And the apologetics for such things are usually centered around the behaviors that the people being killed were engaged in.
He's got reasons for it. And probably the biggest reason, after 400 years of warning, is that the Canaanites were sacrificing their children on the molten hot god Molech, this idol. They would heat this thing up, it was metal, and then they put their babies on the arms of this being, this idol, and watch their babies sizzle to death.
Why do their behaviors matter if God is a source of morality? Shouldn't it just be the source of morality said it was okay to do that, therefore it was? Justifying the biblical genocides by appealing to the behavior of the people that were supposed to be exterminated is borrowing from secular moral philosophies. There shouldn't need to be an explanation. If God is the source of morality, and God wrote morality on our hearts, then the idea that God's actions are immoral shouldn't even occur to us. They should just appear moral to us, because they line up perfectly with the source of our morality. And I think apologists understand that with how the Bible is written, it's actually dangerous to simply say that something is moral because God says so. Because when people start thinking that God is moral and as the source of morality he doesn't need justifications for his actions, then all of his actions are moral by default, and we get atrocities committed in God's name, with the people committing them sincerely believing that they are doing God's will. And given what the Bible has to say about God's will, that is a dangerous position to hold because a lot of times, violence can be justified with an appeal to the Bible. And as long as we're talking about immorality, the Bible flat out says that humans desire immoral things, and modern Christians tend to believe that God is omniscient. So, question 6, does that mean that God knows what it feels like to want to sin? Lust is a sin. Does God know what lust feels like? Since lust is a feeling, that would mean that God has felt lust, which would mean that God has sinned, which would mean that God is not all good. And rather than go into more detail on this one, I will just leave a link up in the this corner. I think it's in this corner. Corner over here to a Dark Matter 2525 video on the subject. And there will be a link in the description because the cards are semi-reliable-ish. Question 7. Why is the church not unified when Jesus prayed that it would be? Sub-question, why should we expect our prayers to do anything when not even God himself could pray in a way that would result in his prayer being answered? Jesus, on multiple occasions, had God refuse to answer his prayer, or he was answered with a no. In Gethsemane, he prayed that this cup would be taken from him, and he affirmed that it would be possible for God to accomplish all his goals without the crucifixion, but God said, nope, and sent Jesus to his death. But before all that, Jesus prayed specifically that everyone who believes in him, not only the ones who were with him at the Last Supper, but everyone who comes to believe in him through their word, would be perfectly unified. And this unification is specifically so that the world can know that Jesus is who he claimed to be. So this request seemed to be pretty much in line with God's desires. But God apparently said no to himself for asking himself to do something that he wanted to do. So today, we have literally thousands upon thousands of Christian denominations, with churches splitting for every conceivable reason, no matter how petty. Hell, the church I grew up in had a schism when they purchased a drum set. They didn't even use it for Sunday services, that was still a pipe organ and a choir. The drum set was for the youth ministry, which was floundering. But drums are of the devil, apparently, so half the congregation split off. And just for the sake of closure, no, the drum set did not save the youth ministry. The church sold the building and now rents space in another church. So the 9 a.m. service is one denomination and the 11 a.m. service is a different denomination. Actually, I think they're the same denomination. But heaven forbid you just combine the two congregations to form one larger congregation. Apparently, unifying isn't a possibility. Take that, Jesus! And as long as we're talking about Jesus being wrong about stuff, question 8. What advice did he give that was actually special? One of the things I frequently hear from apologists is that atheists have a hard time with the fact that Jesus was this amazing teacher, giving us moral lessons that were way ahead of his time. But usually the best teaching that anyone can come up with for him is the golden rule: do unto others as you would have others do unto you. That's a concept that can be found in most religions and moral philosophies, dating back at least to the 500s BCE, possibly earlier. So, not exactly a revolutionary teaching by the time Jesus showed up. Jesus also taught that he who wants to be great must be a servant, so humility. But humility is basically a cornerstone of a bunch of religions that predate Christianity, and at least one that predates Judaism, that is, Hinduism. So again, nothing out of the ordinary for a religious leader of the time. But Jesus taught to love your enemies, just like Buddha did before him. And I could go on. For every example I am aware of that has Jesus teaching something good and uplifting, we can find that same teaching in religions and cultures that predate Jesus. And Jesus also taught a lot of things that are just downright harmful. Don't worry about tomorrow, where or how you'll get your food or clothes. God will take care of it as sure as he cares for the birds. Speaking of God taking care of the birds, have I ever told you guys about the bird that built a nest in one of our windows, laid its eggs there, and then disappeared never to return, and then the eggs got eaten by squirrels? God will take care of you, just like he takes care of the birds. And let's not forget about that time the Prince of Peace said, "Do not think that I have come to bring peace to the earth. I have not come to bring peace, but a sword. For I have come to set a man against his father, and a daughter against her mother, and a daughter-in-law against her mother-in-law, and a person's enemies will be those of his own household. Whoever loves father or mother more than me is not worthy of me, and whoever loves son or daughter more than me is not worthy of me. And whoever does not take his cross and follow me is not worthy of me. Whoever finds his life will lose it. Whoever loses his life for my sake will find it." That kinda sounds more than a little bit like a violent call to arms, and whatever it might really mean, don't pretend that it's never been used as a call to arms. You'd think that God in human form could have been less ambiguous if he actually did not mean that as a call to arms. And it was probably used in conjunction with Luke 19:27, where he commands you to bring his enemies and slaughter them before him. Yes, it's a parable, and so it doesn't have to be taken literally, but again, it's very easy to interpret as a call to violence. If God didn't want it to be a call to violence, he could have just avoided using violent language. It's not that hard to do. Hell, even some of Jesus' supposedly good teachings are actually really bad advice. Turn the other cheek, for instance. Turning the other cheek when slapped is a metaphor, not for forgiving people who have wounded you, as it is so often used, but for being submissive to those who are evil. Do not resist those who are evil. Give them extra opportunity to abuse you. In fact, this part of Jesus' sermon also says that if someone sues you for your tunic, give them your cloak as well. In other words, if you're being sued, as a Christian, you should not be defending yourself. You should give the person suing you more than they are asking for. Not sure how that would work for Mike Lindell when he likely doesn't even have the $1.3 billion that he's being sued for to begin with, but anyway, I've never seen a teaching of Jesus that actually amounts to anything special, and there's a lot that is just downright bad. But somehow, I still fairly regularly hear that atheists cannot deny that Jesus was a great moral teacher, despite the inability to find any great moral teachings in his words. And while we're on the subject of Jesus' teachings, one of the last things he said before ascending, apparently physically upward towards space, which apparently is where heaven is, was that there will be signs that accompany people that believe in him. They will cast out demons, speak in tongues, handle serpents, be unharmed by the drinking of poison, and heal the sick. So, question 9. Why don't these signs accompany believers? The casting out of demons is basically untestable. Most exorcisms appear to be on people who are mentally ill or epileptic, and demons have never been demonstrated to actually be the cause of any illness. So we can't even test that one. Now, for speaking in tongues, there are certainly denominations that engage in the speaking of tongues, or glossolalia, but when the speech is analyzed, a few things become apparent. First, it's not a language. It's too repetitive, and the number of sounds made are way more limited than what are contained in actual language. And as a nice little kicker, the sounds that are used to make up the syllables being spoken are always sounds that are common in the speaker's native language. For instance, you won't hear a native English speaker that doesn't speak any other languages suddenly start using the click consonants that are found in several African languages. The English speaker will only use sounds that are common in English. Now, maybe when the Holy Spirit inspires people to speak in tongues, it just so happens to only give the people the ability to speak in overly simplistic languages that sound like the speaker's native language, but it seems to me that it would be more clearly not made up gibberish if these people could speak, you know, actual languages instead of these new languages that are indistinguishable from gibberish. The next sign, they will pick up serpents with their hands. I mean, that's nothing special. It doesn't even say they have to be venomous serpents, so I think the Appalachian snake handlers can calm down a bit. They might have a higher survival rate for their church services if they started using garter snakes, though that is admittedly less impressive. But nobody tell them about the drinking deadly poison part in the next sentence, because I doubt very much that no Christian has ever been successfully poisoned. But then we have this last one, laying hands on the sick, and they will recover. It doesn't say they might recover, it doesn't say they will only recover if it's God's will that they recover, it says that they will recover. Full stop. No room for interpretation, they will recover. And yet, Christians die all the time of various diseases. Hell, we're in the middle of a pandemic, and you don't have to look very far to find stories of outbreaks that led to multiple deaths being traced back to church gatherings. And the same was true in the 1918 flu pandemic. So, during pandemics, churches seem to be hotspots of disease spread. But Christians are supposed to have the power to heal the sick, so they should be safe havens from disease, shouldn't they? There are two potential responses to this that I can think of. First, that the people pretending to heal people of COVID, like Kenneth Copeland, who declared that COVID was over and done with right before it got really bad, aren't true Christians, and this would kind of tie into the second response, which is that God wants people to be humble, so if their miracle healing powers were too obvious, it'd go to their heads and they'd stop being humble. But the healing power is supposed to be part of the signs that will accompany believers. It's supposed to be obvious to non-Christians that these Christian folks are special. But by all appearances, they have none of these special powers, and the sects of Christianity that are most likely to encourage faith healing also tend to have higher instances of people dying from treatable diseases due to lack of treatment. And finally, question 10, which is a question that I think is a rather fitting way to finish one of these 10 questions videos, which is, which 10 commandments are the 10 commandments? The 10 commandments appear 3 times in the Pentateuch, twice in Exodus and once in Deuteronomy. The ones in Exodus 20 and Deuteronomy 5 are basically the same, and they are the typical 10 commandments that are referenced by Protestants. The Catholic list is slightly different, or else they'd run into problems with the graven images one. But here's a fun fact. Exodus 20 never refers to its commandments as the 10 commandments. The phrase the 10 commandments only appears in the text 3 times. Deuteronomy chapters 4 and 10 both mention the 10 commandments and that they were written on stone tablets, but it doesn't say which set of commandments is the correct set. So where else does the Pentateuch mention the 10 commandments? Exodus 34. And this time, it is specific about what the 10 commandments are. They are the ones that are written on the new tablets, the ones written by God himself, right there in Exodus 34. This set is to replace the set from Exodus 20 that got smashed when Moses found the Hebrews disobeying the rules that they hadn't been given yet. And as bad as the Exodus 20 commandments are, these ones are decidedly worse. Basically, it's hatred for other tribes and religions, observe all the right feasts, yeast is gross, sacrifice the firstborn of everything to God, potentially even the human babies, depending on how you interpret it, and don't cook baby goats in their mother's milk. And these are the rules that God thought so important that he would write them with his own hand on the tablets, and they would be preserved for the Hebrews in the Ark of the Covenant. And these are also the ones that the text of the Bible clearly labels the Ten Commandments. Yes, most Bibles have headings that present the other two sets as though they are the Ten Commandments, but those headings are not in the original text. They were added to clarify sections for modern readers. Now, I know the Exodus 20 set were written on tablets as well, and they are heavily implied by the text to be the Ten Commandments, so I'm not saying that they were not the Ten Commandments, but it is explicitly stated that the Exodus 34 commandments are being written to replace those ones, and they are supposed to be identical, but they are most definitely not identical. So why do Christians almost universally ignore the Exodus 34 commandments when the Bible makes it quite clear that those are the Ten Commandments? And that's it for this one. Today's comment of the day comes to us from Pumpkin J, who adds a couple more questions to my 10 questions list to bring the total up to 12, almost as many questions as there are commandments in the Ten Commandments of Exodus 34. So Pumpkin J asks, what if the omnipotent deity isn't actually good? Maybe it's still the God of the Old Testament and just stood behind the Catholic Church because that's what it wanted to do. Next thought, what if that God sent messages to all religions just to see the world burn? Well, in my opinion, those two scenarios make a whole lot more sense than the idea that God loves us and wants what's best for us. But most likely to me, obviously, is the idea that God just doesn't exist. And actually, I know Jay, I'm pretty sure that they share this opinion. Thanks for watching! Special thanks as always to my patrons, Mark McManus, Mark Ketchum, Clench Eastwood, Lynn Dobbs, What Jesus, and all the rest, who are the answers to the question that is my channel. If you'd like to be 42, you can join us on Patreon for as little as $1 per week over at patreon.com/vicerhino. If you feel so inclined, you can also support the channel through direct donation or my Amazon wishlist. Links to social media, all the ways to support the channel, and to my other projects like my podcast with my daughter can be found at links.vicerhino.com. If for whatever reason you want to send me stuff, my P.O. Box address is in the description. See you next time! Whoopsie doodles. Cat laser. Cat laser. Cat laser. Will you be mine? Cat laser. Cat laser.